Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler Podcast, Episode 88. Today, the Amateur Traveler Podcast talks about tips for travel photography.
I got my bags packed, I'm on a roll. I'm heading out there, and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo. Oh, no. 15-hour flight, oh, I don't think I'll ever be coming home. You know I love it. I got to see one more coffee. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. The first news story I have for you today comes from concierge.com. Apparently some airlines, at least 10 airlines, are considering a new economy class seat configuration where the middle seat faces backwards. Apparently it saves space, should make it easier for dealing with the shared armrests. I don't know whether people are going to like it or not. It's interesting to see. So check out it. I'll put a picture of it on the amateurtraveler.com site as well as a link to the full article. And the second rather amusing story. Apparently, British Airlines, like all the other airlines, edits films for showing on flights. And they edited the film Casino Royale, the most recent James Bond film, but they didn't edit it to cut out violence, but to delete a cameo by the person who runs Virgin Atlantic, Richard Branson. So, there you go, the edited for airline version of the film. In the final story, there is a new cheap carrier that will be flying in the United States. Skybus is a new budget airline that has announced it will begin service May 2nd of 2007 from Columbus, Ohio. The airline has a fleet of 150-seat Airbus A319 jets. Will serve Burbank, Kansas City, Boston, Fort Lauderdale, Seattle, Greensboro, and Oakland, California. Starting on June 12th, and they will reserve 10 seats on every flight, not just an ongoing promotion, but from the beginning on, for $10 each way. So if those destinations are of interest to you, you might look into them right now while those seats are still available. I'd like to welcome the show Andrew Darlow. And Andrew is a professional photographer, been a professional photographer for over 15 years. He has a online magazine and podcast called The Imaging Buffet. And he has lived in the U.S. and Japan and Europe and taken travel photography around the world and has a new book coming out also. Andrew, I think your book is, 31 Inkjet Tips and Techniques, an Essential Printing Resource for Photographers. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you.
We've been working on this interview for a while. I think we first talked in February, but one of the things we wanted to do was get a little closer to the book coming out. So I've been looking forward to this. As you know, I'm a big lover of photography, so I'm excited about this.
Yes, I'm always inspired by both your pictures from when you go away and also many of your guests. And just a small correction, if it was 31 inkjet tips and techniques, it would have been out a long time ago. But it's taken so long because it's 301.
Yeah. It's written right there in front of me, but my apologies for that.
No problem. And it'll have over 100 of my travel photographs. And this is a way for me to share my pictures with the world. So I'm really happy about that as well.
Now, one of the things that we wanted to do, have Andrew on, we've done actually three shows. This will be the third show on travel photography, but from different photographers, myself included, and then Chris Marquardt of Tips from the Top Floor, and now Andrew. And I think it's useful to do this periodically because it is so important to people when you have gone that far and then you come back and don't see the picture that you were looking for when you develop your film or when you get it off the digital camera. It's very disappointing. So, Andrew, I think you've got some tips for us in terms of how to take those pictures that we see in the coffee table books that we want to take when we go traveling.
Absolutely. Yes, I've prepared some things because I think that I learn best when people, you know, speak about their experiences and give specific tips about their world when they go places. So I hope that I can bring that same amount of advice to others. So to start out with, you do need a camera. that's somewhat.
This is my problem.
somewhat obvious, but it's not as easy as it might seem because you could get either a digital or a film camera. I'm really highly going to recommend digital cameras. But even within the world of digital cameras, you have still digital cameras, you have point and shoot, you have DSLRs, but now you also have video cameras that can do really good still pictures. So you may just want to get a good quality video camera that does both video and stills. And of course, then there's camera phones, which, you know, before, actually a short time ago, I would have really just laughed. But that being said, some of the camera phones are getting really good. And in many cases, that's all that some people are going to need. And it's always there, which is probably, you know, the most important thing is to actually have the camera with you, you know, when that big polar bear comes out of the forest or behind the glacier. So anyway, it's important just to be ready and to have a camera. So Nokia, I know, makes some really good camera phones. And, you know, I personally prefer DSLRs because I'm a serious photographer, and many serious amateurs now are buying DSLRs with, you know, have interchangeable lenses.
Can I get you to define DSLR? I know what you're talking about, but I don't want to get too buzzword happy right away.
Oh, absolutely. So a DSLR would be a digital SLR camera and single lens reflex, and it uses a digital sensor. So some of the examples are the new Sony Alpha or the Canon XTI or the Nikon D40X. These are all under $1,000 with a lens, and they're all really good quality DSLRs. And there are $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 DSLRs. I should also mention the most popular group of cameras are known as point and shoots. These are generally made for still photography, and there's a huge number of these. And I'm going to give you two specific websites which have more reviews than you could ever want with regard to these pocket cameras, which do a fantastic job. And in many cases, they do good video as well. So you can also, instead of buying sort of a traditional video camera that does stills, you can buy a traditional still point and shoot camera that does video.
And actually, some of the Amateur Traveler video editions have been shot on a small Canon digital point and shoot camera.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I remember one from Africa.
Africa is actually shot from a video camera.
Okay.
Some aren't. I forgot mm-hmm. there's a mixture there. And the other thing we should say before we leave this topic, SLR, the traditional reason that that's a good thing for those who are non-photographers is that we're talking about that what you see through the viewfinder is the same thing that the lens sees. And if anybody's ever cut the heads off somebody because they were focusing through the viewfinder and on an old point-and-shoot camera, that's part of the reason why. Okay.
Yes. Great.
So get a camera.
Yes. Absolutely. Camera helps.
And so, a camera that you're going to have with you, which you point out. Although I still think if the polar bear comes out behind the tree, you might have other problems other than do you have your camera. But
okay. I suppose.
Okay. And okay. What's your second tip there?
Well, next is to bring extra batteries. So one of the things that can really, you know, put a damper on your day is to like arrive at the summit of Haleakala in Maui or Mount Fuji, and then your battery power has left your camera. So batteries, you know, they're relatively inexpensive. So I recommend having at least one or two spare batteries for every camera or video camera that you own. If you have two cameras, if you're more, you know, serious about your photography, for example, you can get a camera like the Canon 5D. It uses the same battery as the Canon D60, for example, or 30D. So sometimes manufacturers just upgrade the line and they keep the same batteries, which is really nice because then you can have two, three, or four batteries and then share them between the different cameras. And also I like rechargeable AA nickel metal hydride batteries because not only are you helping the environment because you can keep recharging them, they're really good when you want to use a flash. And some cameras will allow you to use AA's. So keep that in mind as well when you're buying a camera.
Now, I suspect that this is one of those tips that was learned the hard way. What's the shot for you that got away because you ran out of battery?
Okay, I was shooting like all day at the Westminster Dog Show in Madison Square Garden like 3 or 4 years ago. And it was just at Best in Show, and I decided to climb up to the highest nosebleed seats. And just as the Best in Show was happening, I had been shooting all day, and I had like two or three batteries, and they were all gone. So I just, I sort of did what I do sometimes. I take out the battery, I shake it, and then I pray a little, and then I put it back in. And often I'm able to get an extra shot or two, but that really bothered me, and that's something that makes me want to have more like four or five batteries with me. And many pros will have that many batteries with them.
Okay.
But if your battery does die and you take it out and or if you just wait a little while, you can often get some more pictures if you're really in a bind.
Yeah, I find with my small point-and-shoot, when I'm not using my my other larger camera, it will think it's out of battery sooner than it is, and I'll take out the battery and put it back in, and it'll get a few more shots and repeat.
So. Yes. Lessons hard learned.
Yes. And what's your next tip?
Next would be to bring extra media cards, and just like with the batteries, it would be a good idea if you're going to have different cameras. Try to get cameras that take the same media. One of the most popular media is called the SD card format. And a lot of both digital video cameras, like the ones from Panasonic, and a lot of the still point-and-shoot cameras, and even the DSLRs will also take the SD cards. So this is really helpful because, just like with the batteries, you don't have to buy multiple card formats, which, even though they're not incredibly expensive, it all adds up. And there's a tip here. What you don't want to do is take a picture with one camera with one SD card and then give it to your wife or significant other and have them shoot on that same card before you download. The best way to do this is just to go ahead and shoot. Even if you don't fill it, if you almost fill your card, download it to your computer, or there are some portable storage devices, which I can send you some links to. But once you're done downloading, it's important to put it back into that either camera, and then format. Every camera has a way of formatting the card. You want to do that in the camera. This is a way to avoid a lot of headaches and a lot of errors that can happen.
Okay. And one thing we should say, too, about SD card format is that it tends to be right now also the cheapest format because it is so popular.
Yes. 2 gigabytes, it's very inexpensive.
Yeah, I have one camera that's on SD and then an older one that's on a compact flash, and those are more expensive these days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
next would be to choose a camera with a good zoom lens, or whether it's a point and shoot or whether you buy a zoom to go with a digital SLR, you know, the larger cameras. Now, the reason why is because zoom lenses, they allow you a lot more flexibility, and they're getting a lot more compact and light, even the high quality ones. So a range that I really like for travel, and one that allows me to almost never take the lens off the camera, is 18 to 200 millimeters. It's a really good range. And in that range, there's a few companies that make really good lenses. Tamron makes an 18 to 200 DI2 lens. Sigma also has a highly regarded lens in that basic zoom range. So if you think about it, 18 to 200 will allow you to get very wide angles and very telephoto zoom angles of view. And regardless, you should read the reviews because not all lenses are created equal. Even if they appear to have similar specs, some of them are just not made as well. So that's about zoom lenses. And if you're a little more serious, I also recommend having a single fixed fast lens, like an f2.8 50 millimeter lens. This is sort of the classic lens that came with millions of film SLRs in the past. These allow you to get into really dark areas like churches or very, you know, historical places, and you can get really good pictures without too much noise.
Can you think of one time when you were really glad you had that Zoom to get?
I went to Europe last summer, and I was able to go to Paris just for one evening. And one of my favorite objects to photograph is something you may have heard of called the Eiffel Tower.
I've heard of that, yes.
Okay. So the Eiffel Tower, I happened to only point and shoot on that trip because I really wanted to go lightly. Usually I bring a lot of gear, but that particular trip, I was just shooting with one really good quality point-and-shoot camera. But the zoom and the lens is great, so I was able to get a tremendous amount of variety. And you'll see some of the pictures in my low-light article that I was able to get from a really wide view and then a really zoomed view. And whenever you are at a place like Paris and in front of something like the Eiffel Tower, and you can experiment like that, it really makes a difference in your photographs, and it'll keep people from falling asleep when you do slideshows because they'll have to refocus their eyes.
All right.
Okay. Next would be Ziploc brand bags or other, you know, sealable bags or plastic food containers. These are fantastic. You can avoid creating like a rat's nest of wires. If you, for example, take a single USB cable, let's say, and then you make a circle of it and you use twist ties so that it's nicely put together. And then you just put it in a bag by itself and you label it. And now you have something that you can do to all of your separate wires and you can have them all in one place. For example, you can put them all in a food container, or you can just put them into another bag, or just you can even like throw them into a bag because they all have their separate place. One time, a couple of years ago, I went to the security at the airport and I had all my wires were just in my bag. And if you come up to security and there's like 18 feet of wire inside of your bag and it, you know, attached to different, you know, metal objects, it's really not a good thing. So in general, I'm going to recommend that you put your stuff in separate bags, and it really works well. Twist ties, you know, you get them whenever you buy different kinds of bags, or maybe you can buy twist ties as well. So that's one of the big tips, I think, that will make everyone's life easier when they travel.
Okay.
Okay, then how about when you're traveling to a country with different voltages or plugs, you should bring a 4 or 5 or 6 port power strip, just a standard power strip. The power strip is just like any other single plug, but what's nice about it is once you plug it into that other country's wall socket, you now have 4 US or wherever your country is, you have your particular country's outlets, multiples of them. So you don't have to buy multiple transformers. And I think a lot of people don't realize that they can do this. And I think that there's probably an aha moment out there for a lot of people. Because often you have some people have a laptop, they have 3 or 4 different devices that they want to charge at night, but they only bring one transformer or one voltage converter.
Been there, done that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next would be to get a good photo backpack. Now, this is really important because if you're able to easily travel with a lot of your gear, you're going to be much happier. You're going to take better pictures. And I recommend that you get one that looks more like a student backpack so that you don't attract as much attention. If you were to have one with the logo of a really expensive name, yeah, that might attract a little more attention. But if you do have that more expensive name, there is a way to deal with that too. You can use a tape. Tape works because people sometimes put tape over their cameras, the name of the camera and stuff like that. So that's actually a tip and something just to consider. But a good photo backpack, like there's one from LowPro, which I'll send a link to, that you can hold cameras, lenses, you can put some food, you can put a laptop in, a few water bottles, a small tripod, and there are a lot of compartments. So it's not like you have to have a photo backpack, but you need, I think, a good backpack for your photo and video gear. It really makes a difference.
I like your idea about the student backpack because I know, especially when you're traveling in sort of a third world country where you realize that even with a prosumer kind of gear like I have, that I easily can be carrying around a month's wages or a year's wages for somebody. So you definitely are concerned about the physical security of the things that you're bringing. So absolutely. I like not attracting attention.
That is true. and the Bermuda shorts and the you know, whatever, the sports teams t-shirts and things like that. Also consider that that might attract some attention if you are an American or Canadian. Next would be to bring a tripod. A lot of people do not bring a tripod, but any tripod, even the small one, there are so many out there. There are compact ones. There are, you know, ones that are not very heavy, but can even go up as high as like 5 feet tall. These are going to help you make great photos of either night scenes or just where you want to capture really great detail. Or many software programs now have the ability to stitch pictures. So if you do a little research and you learn how, you can do multiple pictures across a panoramic view, and then you can have them stitched together, and it will look like something just fantastic, like really, really beautiful if you do that and you experiment a little bit with that.
Now, what if I've forgotten my tripod and I'm still trying to use my zoom lens? What do you do?
Okay. So what I would do is I would use my camera bag, for example. I'll just turn it on the side and then maybe put that on top of a car. Or I would use a wall and I would just anchor myself behind a wall. Or I would use a chair and maybe a pillow. You can usually find like a little stuffed animal somewhere. You can actually use that as like a bean bag. And a lot of photographers bring around little bean bags that they can rest on objects. So those are just some of the ways in which you can get longer exposures. You can also, and I have a lot of these tips on my low light photography article, you can change the ISO of your camera from, say, a lot of times it's set to like 100 or 200. Often you can put it to 400 or even 800 if you have a better quality camera. So those all help you to get sharper pictures in lower light.
The other trick that I often use too is the self-timer, so right, that you don't have your hands on the camera at the time you're taking it.
Absolutely. As long as you can keep that camera still on an object. Like I was in Chicago and there was this really great restaurant and I didn't have a tripod, but I noticed in the back where they stacked up all of those little like things that they hold the receipts in the when they give them to you, they're like leather cases.
Okay.
Well, they had a whole stack of them. So I put it on top of there and just set it to like 3 seconds. Sometimes you can have both a 3 second or like a 10 second timer. And it's nice to be able just to set it for 3 seconds. And that worked great. So that's a great tip.
The only thing I would add to that is there are some situations, like when I was on a African safari in a Land Rover or a Range Rover, that having a monopod actually worked real well because a tripod does take up a little more space. And then I've heard some people who say that they can get away with a monopod, like in a museum often, if you have a tripod, you're not allowed to use it. Although I think generally either one is going to be banned in those sort of circumstances.
Right. If they notice, a monopod can almost be pretty nondescript, but a tripod can be
used. It's also less
as
likely to trip people, I think, is why they're sometimes yes, able to get away with it.
But I've used tripods also as monopods if you just keep the legs together. And, you know, if you have to, it can be done. If you're in a situation where there's a whole lot of people around and
sure,
you want a little more stability, that can definitely help you.
Okay.
So next would be to – these are more creative tips now. So – take more pictures than you think you need. So
now, than you think you need or than your wife thinks you need?
Yeah, than anyone thinks you need. Well, if you want, you know, to really impress your friends and family, I think that it takes a few more pictures than you might think, because pros might shoot 100 to get one that is, you know, good enough for a magazine. So if you see something really impressive and you're like right in front of it and you have a few extra seconds, just take a few extra photos. Maybe go from horizontal to vertical and think like the director of a photography at a movie. If you watch movies, often the opening scenes are some of the best with regard to the angle of view, where the camera is. But in almost every case, you get an outside sort of wide view, and then you get a middle view, and then you get a close-up of the actor's face. So if you think in this cinematic way, you can take a few wide-angle shots, which would be equivalent to like a 24-millimeter in 35-millimeter terms. You know, there's this thing called a multiplication factor. If you start with digital cameras, you can look into all that. But let's just say in 35-millimeter, if you were to be shooting film, 24-millimeter would be a good wide angle. And then you might take a few medium zoom shots, which would be about 80 millimeters, and then more zoomed-in telephoto, which would be about 150 millimeters or 200 millimeters. And you had mentioned stabilization. Today there is a lot of concern about helping people to get sharper pictures. So one of the ways they do this is to either build image stabilization into lenses. Nikon and Canon both have dedicated lenses that have image stabilization, and it helps because it's sort of trying to feel your vibrations in your hands and try to offset that in the lens. And Sony, with their Alpha 100, has built it in to the actual sensor area. So, and you could see a demonstration of this at trade shows. The whole sensor sort of jiggles around, and that means that any lens that you put on should benefit from the image stabilization. So that's, I think, just good advice to look into if you are someone who you find a lot of your pictures are blurry. And I'll just go back to the low light tips that I have about 14 of them on my site, because I specifically mention how you can help get sharper pictures. And it's not just low light, it's also moving objects. If you have moving objects, you also want to treat them just like if you were in low light.
Well, and I think the one thing that a lot of us have made the mistake is forgetting that we are, in fact, also moving objects while we're taking the pictures, and we're jiggling the camera and come home and we've missed the shot. Or we've got a digital camera now, and so we assumed that we could look at it and see that it was clear, but we didn't zoom in to see that, oh, as I zoom in, I've lost all the detail. I really did jiggle the camera when I was pressing the button there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. There's lessons that you learn from all of your pictures.
Sure.
Okay, next would be, and this is a really important one, I think this is a mistake that a lot of folks make, because it's not self-evident. It's about using fill flash and red-eye reduction properly. And have you ever photographed someone like in front of a bright window and, you know, it's really, you know, the person looks great, and, you know, maybe it's a couple and the background is really bright, and then you notice that they just like look like silhouettes and the background looks great.
Right.
So you can avoid this because most cameras have what's called a fill flash. And usually there's a little lightning bolt and you can press it a few times. And usually if it's just in the lightning bolt position, then it's in a fill flash. Or on digital SLRs, if they have a pop-up flash, then you can often just pop it up and it will engage. And this will give you a really nice fill light. Sometimes it's too much, but the sweet spot would be like between about 4 feet and 12 feet from your subject, just to give you sort of a sense. And on many cameras, you have something called flash exposure compensation. So what you can do is, if you're in those situations, you can actually turn down the power of the flash, and it sort of balances it out more naturally. So hopefully that's clear. It just takes a little bit of experimentation and looking into your camera manual. I know a lot of people don't like to read manuals, but it's a good idea.
And actually read them before you go on the trip, I find. Don't take the new camera without the manual on the trip. Flash, though, the other thing you mentioned, and that I've seen a lot of people do this, what's the sort of maximum effectiveness range for a flash on most cameras?
On most cameras, if it's like a flip-up or if it's on one that just sits next to the lens,
right?
You know, it does depend on the ASA that you set. However, I'm going to say somewhere between 5 feet and about 20 feet is where that flash is actually going to have some influence. So if you're at a, you know, when you watch like the Olympics,
yes, that's exactly what I was thinking of.
You know, all these people are pretty much, you know, getting really good pictures of the 100 people in front of them, the backs of their heads, and they won't be seeing much on the playing field.
Yeah, for me, I think of going to a Giants game when Barry Bonds is up at bat and all the flashes are flashing all around the stadium, and I'm thinking he is, you know, hundreds of feet from you. Your flash won't get there.
No.
The other thing that I see is I see people doing nighttime landscape shots and not realizing they'll get a better shot if they could turn their flash off, because their flash is not going to reach as far as they think.
Exactly. That's sort of the opposite of the fill flash. You can turn your flash off often by clicking on the lightning bolt until it has a flash through it.
Right.
And this comes back to the idea of using a tripod, because the camera manufacturers don't expect you to use a tripod. So they see dark, they want a flash. They want you to use that flash. But if you just understand a little bit about how it works, if you just you want to extend your exposure, so that means that you want to get it on a tripod or be very still, move your ASA up closer to 400 or 800, and then take your pictures without the flash, and you're going to see beautiful results in many, many cases.
But it's very counterintuitive to tell people that you'll get a lighter picture by turning off the flash. But of course, the camera, if it thinks the flash is going to help, sets the settings differently. So I think that's one that I've seen probably more people make mistakes with in low light than any other thing.
Mm-hmm, I agree. And there's sort of the one thing I didn't mention about really bright light. You know, often you're on a tour, you don't have a choice what time you're in front of the Acropolis.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
but you want a picture that at least shows the Acropolis. So what you can do is put on your fill flash, especially if you've ever seen pictures without fill flash, often with sun high in the sky, you get what's called raccoon eye sockets because the shadows are falling down from your face and they're creating those shadows. So the fill flash, as long as you're close enough to your subject, will mitigate that, and you'll get like a really nice balance between your background and people you're photographing.
Okay. The only other thing that reminds me of is you talk about doing bright light photography. The other thing that I see, I think my mother does this all the time, is let's stand facing the sun so that we're all squinting and then take a picture.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, yes. What the best light would be sort of, let's just say, if I'm standing outside, I want the sun at approximately 3 o'clock. So that should give you a good sense of where your photographer should be and where your subjects should be. Either 3 o'clock or 9 o'clock.
Okay. So when you
say 9 or 10 o'clock,
3 o'clock, you're saying off to my right or off to my left hand side.
Exactly. And okay. That it could even be, you know, more like 4 o'clock, because that could be a little more dramatic. Uh-huh. But that being said, just as a general, you don't want it at 12 o'clock.
Right.
it's not going to make for good pictures for anyone. You're going to be squinting, and that is a very good point.
The other thing I think that's a really great point about you're talking about just taking more pictures, and I think this is so important. You were talking, for instance, earlier about using the fill flash if you don't want that silhouette in front of the bright background. But, of course, if you know you're going to get that effect, then maybe that's the effect you're looking for. So I have one picture where it's shot at the north rim of the Grand Canyon in the lodge that looks off on the Grand Canyon, and I have silhouettes of this people who I didn't know in front of this great panorama, and that's what I was looking for. But once you know what you're going to get, then you can do the right thing.
Absolutely. That's actually one of the best tips that I can share, is learn the rules and then break them.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, here's probably my number one creative tip, because this is something that I think separates, in many cases, what you would call quote-unquote pro photographs from amateur photographs, and that is use aperture priority. A lot of people don't know what this means, but I'll try to explain it. Many cameras, even point-and-shoots, have a setting called aperture priority. This means that your aperture, which is generally like between f2.8 and f2.8,
pause here for a second. The mm-hmm. aperture is how big the opening gets on the camera.
Exactly.
Okay.
And a good way to test this, and this is how I teach it in seminars, is if you take your finger and you make a circle with your thumb and your second finger, and you look through it, and then you look at like an object really close to you, and then you close it down really small so that you're just looking through a very small hole that you've made with your thumb and your second finger, mm-hmm. you'll notice that the objects from the foreground and the background actually become sharper looking. And that's the same exact idea. An f2.8 is sort of a very wide opening in your exposure. And that means that, let's say you had someone standing in front of you, about 5 feet in front of you, and then you had five cars all lined up behind them. The first car was 10 feet behind, the second was 20, the third was 30, 40, 50. So they were sort of going out in that direction. If you were to photograph the subject at f2.8, your subject will be really sharp, but then the cars will be blurry just behind her. However, if you go up to like f16, what will happen is your subject will be sharp, and probably the first car will be pretty sharp. Maybe the second car will start to go out of focus, and then all the others will then go out of focus. So that just gives you a sense of what aperture does to your depth of field. And this can be used creatively in so many ways. And if you've seen movies, often they rack focus back and forth so that the subject is really sharp, but then the background is really out of focus. Sports photographs, often you see a pitcher on the mound, and the background is just like a watercolor painting. And that's from shooting at lower apertures like f2.8. And if you can do experimentation with this and you can control this, which you can with aperture priority, you can do different apertures and you can get a really nice range of looks in your picture. So I sometimes take different pictures at different apertures just to see the difference. And the other advantage of shooting at f2.8 or f4, like wider open, is that it allows more light in. So that means that in lower light, you can get brighter pictures with less noise in the dark areas.
Okay.
So hopefully that's helpful. So look for the A on your camera. It's generally an A or an AV. That's what it says.
And generally, when we're talking aperture priority, we've moved away from the point and shoot. This is the first thing. If you're going to want to do this, you're going to want a little better camera to do it.
Actually, many of the good quality point and shoots have aperture priority as a choice. Even
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, even a $200, often like a Canon or Nikon. I mean, some of these you can even shoot in RAW, which is surprising, but RAW is becoming more and more popular. So in a lot of these cameras, you can shoot in the RAW mode. That's a whole nother discussion.
Just quick two-line definition on RAW, as long as you're bringing it up here.
Okay, so RAW camera mode would allow you to essentially capture all of the scene. I mean, there are some limitations, but it allows you to capture essentially a very wide range of contrast and detail compared with JPEG, which is a much smaller range. It will compress it to like 256 levels as opposed to a number of thousands of levels of gradation. So RAW files also allow you to change things later on and have more flexibility with color, the color balance, whether you shot inside or outside. So you have more control over your pictures in many different ways. Once you shoot a JPEG, essentially the picture is done. And I've had this situation where the highlights, once they're blown out, especially in JPEG mode, they're gone. Now, in RAW mode, your highlights...
And blown out highlights here. We've got into the jargon here just a little bit. It's all white. There's too much white. Light in the picture.
And this is usually the biggest headache for photography. Like if people had shot slides before, they'll know what like a blown out area is, pure white. So often with JPEG mode, if you're shooting and things are too overexposed, once they're really gone, they're gone. With RAW, still, you cannot go too far. But with RAW, you can underexpose a little bit and not worry as much and then bring it back to some extent later on so that you can retain more of that highlight detail, which is very important in many pictures, especially in landscape pictures. And one of the other tips is with RAW, and this is in my tip article, it's called auto exposure bracketing, and this allows you to quickly shoot three pictures usually at different settings. So one would be dark, one would be like normal, and one would be light or overexposed. So take a look at that if you want to get more into that. And then if you're on a tripod, you can then bring those pictures into Photoshop or another image editor, and then you can paint in a sky, you can put them on layers, you can have a lot of fun.
Okay.
So hopefully that gives a good sense of RAW and JPEG a little bit.
Yeah, I think the Photoshop is an entirely different... we could spend a lot of time talking about that. But it's very fun to get into, too. I have a picture of Paris where I cleaned the litter out of the street in Photoshop later on.
Okay, so, yes. Yep, well, just don't submit it to a newspaper as photojournalism. People get in trouble for that.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Okay, my last tip for now is to share your photos. So, and I'm sort of guilty. I have tens of thousands of slides and negatives that, you know, it's hard to really share them all. But with digital, it's a lot easier. And there are so many ways. So, for example, online, whether you decide to make it a public or just a private gallery, you can upload your pictures either to a website like blogger.com, or you can create a free account at flickr.com, photobucket.com, shutterfly.com, kodakgallery.com. And there are just so many options for getting your pictures up, and often they're free options, and then you can send people links to look at your galleries, and they can often order pictures right from any of these sites.
Right.
And then if you're on a Windows machine, Picasa is a good choice for like a desktop software and online photo management. It has a nice interface, and you can also publish to the web, and you have a lot of choices with Picasa. and that's a Google product. You can also make soft cover or hardcover books through Apple iPhoto. You may have seen that there's a bookmaking software there, also Apple Aperture. And there's also other companies. One which I'm really impressed by, they're in San Francisco, it's called blurb.com. And they have both Mac and Windows software. And they give you often almost pre-made books, and you just insert your pictures and they look fantastic. They're often hardcover. They may have soft cover options as well. They're inexpensive. And you can also make your own, you know, just go to a scrapbook store or an art supply store. And there's a particular podcast called The Scrapcast. I've met Lynette, who's the host, and she just does a fantastic job. She goes over like every aspect of making scrapbooks, whether it's, you know, choosing adhesives or just information about how to organize your photographs and resources, just all great stuff. And on a similar note, when I lived in Japan, I was 18 years old, first time I went to Japan, and I just was collecting all kinds of stuff. And I think this is a general tip that doesn't necessarily have to do with photography, but I found that some of the best souvenirs were the receipts I got back from the places I visited, or the maps. Often that stuff gets thrown away,
right,
or even single pages torn out from guidebooks. And you can just get an inexpensive scrapbook and put these together and add photographs. And it's just a really nice way to share your memories with your family and you know, for generations to come.
Those are great tips for us, Andrew. The one thing I would say with sharing is if people have photos, there is a Flickr group for the Amateur Traveler, and there's a link from that on amateurtraveler.com. If you put them up there, share them with the rest of the group and let us see what you're doing, especially if you go out here and use Andrew's tips to improve your photography. We'll be putting up Andrew's tips as an article on the site, so if you miss some of the links that he said, you can either rewind and play them again, but I'll also put them up as links along with some pictures that Andrew has taken and some links to his articles and such. Thank you so much for being here. Obviously, I could talk about photography all day, but I think I probably shouldn't because I'm supposed to be at work in a few minutes.
Oh, right. Yeah, I just love photography. Every time I go out, every time I go to a new city, town, it really doesn't matter. It could also just be a local aquarium. I get so energized, and I just love to take pictures and to often with my family, or sometimes if I'm just on my own on a business trip or something, it's just great to get out and see the world. And the pictures just help me to better explain it to friends. And that was probably one of the most important things and the lessons I learned when I was 18 years old. I came back from Japan from 8 weeks living with a family, and words could not explain it. So over 300 pictures did explain it really well, and it made all the difference. And that's, I think, in many ways why I became a professional photographer.
Excellent. I'll let you plug the site and the book again since I screwed it up the first time.
Oh, sure. The website is imagingbuffet.com, and the book is called 301 Inkjet Tips and Techniques, an Essential Printing Resource for Photographers. And that'll contain a lot of different printing tips for using inkjet printers, and just also a lot of photographic information and over 100 of my pictures from my travels around the world. And it's available on Amazon.com. You can just search for Andrew Darlow. I don't have an exact date, but look for it in the next couple months.
And we'll put a link to it. Let me know when it comes out. I'll put a link to it so that people can find it more easily from the website.
Great. Great.
Andrew, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Chris. This is a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Well, both because this show has gone a little over average length and also because I'm recording the ending of this show in Appomattox, Virginia, after attending a family wedding and I'm sitting in the bathroom of our hotel, I think we'll wrap this up and skip the internet resources section of the show. I did have one thing for you in the community section, and that is I forgot to mention in last week's show on Kingston, Ontario, that Kingston, Ontario will be the host for a podcaster conference in June, which is Podcasters Across Borders, which is June 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. So if you want an excuse to go to Kingston and you are a fan of podcasting, either a podcaster or a listener, that might be something to consider. And with that, thanks very much for listening. Please feel free to comment on this show at amateurtraveler.com. Send me an email at host@amateurtraveler.com or call the comment line at 216-MOM-LOVE. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
One more cathedral. I got to-
The best and the brightest served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show, and Limelight.